Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com. Coming up on this Wednesday edition, United Airlines stock prices are falling. They've had some problems with public relations. We've got that story, some more details about that. A surprise move in Iran, potentially. Somebody from the past is maybe making a comeback. And also a home buying crunch for millennials if you're looking to buy a house. They say it might be a little tougher to do. That and more this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG online. We are at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, please do that at kpcgfm. Also, you can email us comments at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau here today on this Wednesday. And the sky looks threatening. Is it going to rain today? What's going to happen?
The forecast said it's supposed to thunderstorm for the last 2 days, but it hasn't done that at all. So,
yeah,
Yahoo weather has let us down again.
My weather app is very general. They're like, maybe. Like, they don't give me the specifics that I want. I need a better app, I think, but I can never trust it.
Yeah, every day it's like 50% chance of rain, 50% chance of sunlight. It's right in the middle. 50-50 chance of either.
They're just playing it safe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what they're doing. They're playing it safe. It doesn't help me out any because I have no idea what's going to happen. But springtime, so a lot of things can happen. I got an email from my insurance provider for my home, all the tornado safety tips they always send out every year because we are getting into that time of the year. But we haven't had too many severe storms this year yet, I guess. Maybe a couple passing ones, but nothing too severe. But we're in that time period. Lots of stories to talk about today. Some interesting sports notes to begin with. If you're a Tony Romo fan, you might have been happy to see him last night. He was at the Dallas Mavericks game, and they let him suit up in full uniform. Tony Romo was a quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys, and he's, as far as I know, he's retired. He's done playing. So the Mavericks, the basketball team, they wanted to kind of do something nice. So they let him suit up full gear. He got to warm up. Mark Cuban jokingly told him to check into the game, which he didn't do. And I don't think it's legal. I don't think you can just randomly play an NBA game. But anyway, there's some video of him warming up. And he, you know, as you'd expect, he's an athlete. He can play a little bit. He had some nice shots.
It looks like he has some moves. He actually hit a nice step-back jumper over Devin Harris in warm-ups.
Yeah, that's the video I was thinking of, too. I thought, he could come play in our pickup league.
Oh, definitely.
We play with him. If Tony ever gets bored, he'd come play with us.
He'd rip us apart.
he would, I'm sure. Yeah.
As long as there aren't any field goals in overtime, I guess, during the game.
You're the one guy that'll heckle him in a pickup basketball game. Let it go.
From like 10 years ago.
Yeah, 10 years ago. Let it go. So he's going to be, I think, if everything goes like they're saying, he's going to be the top analyst for CBS. For their football.
They fired Phil Simms, didn't they?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Which,
I'm not expecting that.
Just a couple of years ago, people talked about Phil Simms like he was the best guy. I never really thought he was. Personally, I didn't care for him all that much. But yeah, a lot of people really did like him. And so all of a sudden, he's out. And I was watching a sports commentator, and they were saying, you know, even if you're really good at it, it takes time to get good at it. They were saying, you know, that you have, I don't know, 50 times or something like that in a football game to speak for about 8 seconds, and everything's got to be good. It's a lot of pressure, and it's kind of on the fly. Mm-hmm. So he seems like a real personable guy, Tony Romo. I think he'll do good. He'll do well with it, but it does take time to get good at announcing sports.
Definitely. They're throwing him right into the fire, giving him the top spot right away. And I mean, if that falls through, that's a pretty bad decision for the network there.
You just got to pair somebody with Al Michaels. He'll make anybody look good. You could put a piece of toast next to Al Michaels, and they're like one of the top commentators in the world. I don't know. Al Michaels is just the master of that. Here's another interesting sports note from yesterday. I always like it when animals take the field and disturb people. Rally Cat takes over, takes cover, rather, in Miami Marlins outfield. They were hitting a lot of baseballs out there. A gray cat went scrambling for cover in the Marlins Park outfield midway through Tuesday night's game. I think he's kind of a cute-looking cat. Depends if you like cats or not. Announced attendance was 36,519 people, and that didn't include a cat that ran onto the field midway through the game. It scurried along the outfield warning track, ran away from right fielder Stanton, crawled up the center field wall, and then appeared to get stuck in the animatronic home run sculpture. You know, that sounds like a great day at the ballpark.
Yeah.
Sounds like you can make a movie about that. This harrowing story.
Yeah, whatever the cat's name is, we'll call him Buster just for fun. Buster's Day at the Park. Buster's Day Out, something like that.
There have been some pretty interesting occasions of animals sort of interfering, especially at ballparks where baseball games are being played. I actually saw a clip a few days ago of a Cleveland Indians game, and there was just a flock of geese congregating in center field, and a line drive was hit up the middle. It hit one of the birds, and the ball changed direction and went past the center fielder, allowing a run to score. So
wow.
The goose actually interfered in the game and helped the other team.
How do you score that? Is it an error?
No,
by
I don't
animal?
I don't think so.
An animal error? Yeah, there's that famous video of that seagull flying in front of Randy Johnson when he threw. He could throw 110.
He blew that bird up.
Hit the bird and it exploded.
Yeah.
So that's on YouTube if you want to check it out. I always tell kids about that in Little League for some reason. I'm like, hey, did you ever see that time when? And most cases they hadn't heard of it, and then they always come back the next day and they're like, I saw what you meant.
Hopefully they don't start trying to do it.
That guy could throw the baseball. It was hard.
It looked like the ball exploded into feathers.
Yeah.
But actually, a bird just perfectly timed an intercepting course.
Right, you can never time it. But you know, it's so funny how. Actually, that reminds me of a story. We got some guys playing Little League baseball, and we have one guy playing in the outfield, and he had two plays in a row where he was trying to throw the ball to second base, and he hit the runner in the helmet while he was running all the way from outfield. Two plays in a row, and it hit the guy that was moving. And I was like, how could you do that?
Did you see that Cardinals-Cubs game a week or two ago, starting off the season, where the Cardinals batter got hit by a pitch, so he went to first base. Then he stole second, and the throw from the catcher to second base hits him in the arm. And then as he's scoring on a hit, he comes home, and the ball hits him in the head as he slides into home plate.
Yeah.
So he got hit three times, and it was almost like, are the Cubs trying to hit this guy?
Right.
He was just limp on the ground as if he were dead because he'd just been pelted three times in a row.
Yeah, well, especially in the majors, you're gonna have some welts. Those guys can zip that ball. Tim Tebow, if you're following him, he's playing minor league baseball. Two home runs now. He's got two. He hit a home run his first at bat in the minors. So, I mean, from what I understand, it's not like the best of the minors, but, you know, hey, he's doing something. So people are down on him, but he keeps rising to the occasion.
Yeah, it's two more home runs than I have when I play baseball.
So, right. Right. You know, it's interesting. They had a write-up a while ago about minor league baseball, what those guys get paid, but they don't get anything. They're making like $11,000 a year. That's it. And I don't know that. I think, like, if they eat at the stadium, it's like, stuff from the concession stands. Yeah. Like, yeah, here's an old burger or something. You know, just the difference between that and then if you make it to the majors and everybody's making millions. Most everybody. I don't know if the lowest paid player is, but people are making huge money. But in the minors, so guys are chasing their dream for a while, but if you never get that call up, you know, that's the prime of your life and you never quite make the cash.
Right. I believe the minimum in the major leagues is something like $500,000. But if you are in the minor leagues, one of the best players, you might not have anything hardly at all. So that's there are obviously differing arguments on that. But if you did give these guys a hefty salary in the minor leagues, what would be the motivation to move up? If you're already living comfortably down there, guys would not be scrapping and playing their hearts out trying to get to the top level.
I suppose you don't want professional minor leaguers per se.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always a challenge to know what to do. So that's why I gave it up years ago and was never invited to play. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show is coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Richard Palmer today. Make sure you listen for that program. Also, stop and check out thetrumpet.com, some of the headlines today. Top story, unraveling the KKK with friendship. You might have heard a little bit about this on The Sun Also Rises a few weeks back with Jeremiah Jacques. This is the write-up for that. Normally when a person is hated, he says, he hates right back, but not Daryl Davis. Really inspiring story. You can read about that at thetrumpet.com, and you can also listen to the program on The Sun Also Rises. Related to that, how to solve America's race problems. That's a write-up by Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury, and that is there as well at thetrumpet.com. A couple of headlines for today. You guys remember Ahmadinejad? How do you say his name?
That's right.
Ahmadinejad.
Okay. Because there's always different ways people say things. Ahmadinejad.
Yes. Yeah.
In a surprise move, Iran's Ahmadinejad to run for president. So this is interesting. Iran's former president, Mahmoud, right?
Yes, I think so.
M-A-H-M-O-U-D. How do you get Mahmoud out of that? I never understand that.
There's no C in there.
It's like Mahmoud. That's what it should be, but it's Mahmoud.
I think in Arabic it'd say Mahmoud, and then the English transliteration isn't...
It's different.
...isn't exactly right. How it sounds, I guess.
Right. We don't have the exact... Yeah.
Yeah.
But on Wednesday, which is today, stunned the country by unexpectedly filing to run in the May presidential election, contradicting a recommendation from the Supreme Leader to stay out of the race. So I never know when things come out of Iran. I never know like how much of it's accurate or how much of it is some sort of a show. They have this sort of election, but does it even matter? I mean, they kind of just pick who they want. The Supreme Leader picks, doesn't he? So they have this sort of the show of things. I'm not exactly sure how much of it's like how it works. But anyway, so they're talking about this as a surprise move and everyone was shocked by it. And yeah, maybe. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think this months ago, even last year, I heard rumors he might try to run again just because Rouhani, the current president, is considered a moderate, quote unquote. I think Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel summed up best when he said, Ahmadinejad was a wolf's in wolf's clothing, and then Rouhani was a wolf in sheep's clothing. So they're both pursuing the same goals, just in maybe one just uses less fiery rhetoric than the other. But the elections in Iran are a hoax. I mean, it doesn't matter who's elected. They could elect some democratic leader who hates the Iranian regime, and the Supreme Leader is still going to call the shots on everything. It's just, I think, more to appease people who maybe want more democracy in the country, but really it doesn't mean much.
Yeah. Well, this will be interesting to see what happens. One of the people I talked to over there, a person by the name of Farhadian, who backs reformists, he said it was an organized mutiny against Iran's ruling system. I don't think so. I wouldn't think so. If you go up against the ruling system, I don't think you survive, do you?
Yeah, well, I think in Iran, they try to move to more like a reforming type kind of government, or at least image. And what might be worrying for the U.S. is now Rouhani struck the deal with the U.S., the deal, quote unquote, nuclear deal. And a lot of people in Iran didn't like that. And so I think they prefer a leader like Ahmadinejad that just says things, makes a big show of standing up against the United States, is much more belligerent. And that could be, if he is elected or someone like him, it could be a big problem for the U.S. because now you don't have an Iran that's playing the part and trying to be an ally with the U.S. like Rouhani kind of did. You have someone who says, I'm going to destroy you over and over again, which is kind of the... Iran's done that all along anyway, for the most part. So I think it's more of a prestige thing, more about how the international community perceives Iran, the president's role, rather than actually it being a fundamental change of government.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see what happens there, and I'm sure there'll be more about that at thetrumpet.com. And Brett Noctegal is over in Jerusalem, so he keeps his eye on the Middle East really well there, and he has, of course, watched Jerusalem here on KPCG, and so I'm sure there'll be more updates about that as we get closer to that election, which is coming up in May. He was kind of a surprise guy when he got elected the first time. He kind of came out of nowhere, from what I recall, because most people had not heard of him, I don't think.
Yeah, and he was definitely the most hardline president they've ever had. It'll just be really interesting to see what direction Iran takes or what the Supreme Leader wants.
I'd be fascinated to know kind of what these guys' lives are like over there, you know, for like, say, Ahmadinejad, where he's been. He was president, then he's not. You know, what's their life like? Do they live pretty good? I would imagine they do, but it'd be interesting to see. Every once in a while, you get a glimpse into some of those nations, and it's fascinating to see how the upper echelon lives. I know the people on the street there, they probably live pretty low, but, you know, what do you do when you used to be president and now you're not? Like, how does he fit into the social structure? It's sort of an odd... I just wonder about those things.
Even as president, didn't he stay in his modest little home that where he was before? And I think maybe he's even still there now. I don't think he was looking to necessarily make himself look richer than all the people, because maybe that could make some people upset. So he seems like he's kind of just kept his lifestyle the same for the most part. But speaking of the Supreme Leader and his power there, I don't know if him announcing is rigged or if he actually is upsetting the Supreme Leader, because if that's the case, then Ahmadinejad might need to watch out.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. You wouldn't want to push up against the power too much. We saw what happened in that, the Green Revolution, I guess? What it was when they tried to have an uprising and that got squashed? Meanwhile, the rest of the Middle East turned over, but they squashed that pretty quickly. That was back in, 2009 or so? Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is another story here, an ongoing one. You've seen the video, no doubts. A big story here in the U.S. United Airlines faces more questions as dragged passenger hires high-powered attorney. So everyone has seen the footage, right? This guy got dragged off the flight. And at first, United said, well, hey, he was belligerent. That's within our rights. There's quite a backlash to it. Now they've come out and said, we're so sorry. This shouldn't have never happened. So they're changing their tune because the passenger now has got a high-powered attorney, and the stock prices have fallen for United and has cost them a fair bit of cash.
Wow.
So the public perception there is not good for them, and it's hurting their bottom line.
Yeah, I think I saw yesterday. This is yesterday, so it's changed since then, but they've lost $800 million since that news story first came out. And so... yeah, it's just puzzling. It's something that we never would expect to see from an airline, and then even having an airline defend that kind of thing. I mean, it's hard because the details are still kind of fuzzy or like going back and forth. But apparently on the tickets, they have the right to remove passengers if they so choose. Like, that's part of the agreement. However, I think everyone would probably disagree with the way it was handled.
Yeah, I think, we all assume if we bought a ticket, we're going to be on that flight.
Yeah.
Unless we did something or there was a problem of some kind. You know, I bought the ticket, why can't I be on this flight? It is infuriating, I can understand. Particularly, you don't know. I mean, you don't know why somebody needs to get someplace. If you're on vacation and maybe it's not a big deal, But what if you got to get to work or you've got to go do a wedding or, you paid for the ticket. That is an upsetting thing.
Right. And at least in this case, though, he was being replaced by other flight crews. I guess there were maybe four members of another flight crew who had to be transported to a different airport to staff a different flight. But obviously no one wants to get delayed like that, even if they are on vacation or not in a rush at all. But it's kind of hard to feel too terrible for him because... obviously, if they're going to start using force on you, you might just want to comply instead of, squealing and then getting dragged off. I couldn't believe he let himself just get dragged off like that. Just get up and walk out.
Yeah, it was quite an ordeal. I've never seen anything like that. I've seen people be asked to leave, hey, we're oversold. And there's always been people that have volunteered, so maybe they didn't need to get someplace quickly. And if they make it worth your while, I've considered it a time or two, but it was never... the pot was never juicy enough for me. Throw in an extra $500 and now we're talking. But so anyway, the stock prices have taken a hit, as you mentioned, Abraham. At the close of trading Monday, the airline was valued at about $22.49 billion. At around noon on Tuesday, its value had sunk to $21.92 billion, a loss of more than $500 million at that time. By close of trading, its value had recovered a little bit to $22.25. Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, which owned about 9% of outstanding United shares as of February, lost more than $23 million. Give me one guy gets mad. There's a video. It goes on the internet. You lose $23 million. Now he's got a lot of money to play with, but still, the power of people being able to videotape things and put it up online, it really changes a lot.
Yeah, and that guy, I mean, obviously no one wants to get physically beaten, but he really did have a flair for a dramatic. I mean, he was squawking. I mean, he was like, oh, oh. I mean, it's hard not to even just laugh whenever you see someone acting that way. It was like a toddler throwing a tantrum. I mean, it is what it is. You got selected randomly by the computer. Just get off the plane. Don't cause a scene for everyone else. And then now he's trying to get them in big trouble. And then you see what happens to people who just have stocks. A lot of people lose money because one guy decides to be belligerent like that.
Yeah, you know what would be really interesting is if situations like this set a precedent. So this guy's he is lawyering up, and let's assume there is some. I would imagine United wants it to go away, so they'll probably pay him something or whatever. But going forward, if people know that you could maybe have this sort of situation happen, I think people, some cases, would be more inclined to protest, and then maybe, you know. Maybe something occurs and then they get a payout or whatever. It shouldn't be that way. You'd hope it wouldn't be that way. But unfortunately, that would probably occur. And then the airlines are going to have to decide how they're going to handle this in the future. What do you do?
That is a big question. What does the airline do? What should they have done differently in this situation if there is no getting around the fact that other flight crew has to get on the plane so that they can go to their actual destination to staff another flight? There's no way around that. It's not a pleasant situation for anyone there. But if every single person refuses to get off the plane, and even the ones selected refuse to get off the plane, are they just supposed to stand there for 10 hours staring at the guy, hoping that maybe eventually he'll decide to get up and leave? I don't really know what else the airline's supposed to do there either.
Yeah, and then there's always a chance that the rest of the people on the flight get upset.
Yeah.
You know how it is if you're trying to get somewhere and you're waiting on the one guy
right.
And he finally gets on the plane. Everyone's like, that guy. it's a lot of high emotion, high stress when people are traveling. I think sometimes the worst comes out of people, and that would just be a bad situation to be in. So I'm glad I don't have to fly too much.
Yeah. It's just talking about flight travel in general. It's just getting more expensive. People aren't necessarily happy with the conditions we talked about, like the seats being too small, and especially if you're a taller or a bigger person and all those sorts of things. It's you have to pay for all your bags now. You have to pay for pretty much all the food you get on the plane, no more. Not a whole lot of complimentary things anymore. So there's just a lot of, I think, discontent with it, and maybe there could be some reforms. And I think this, if there's a lawsuit or some kind of big legal kerfuffle over this, it could maybe spark a lot of reform, maybe some, and maybe a lot of bad press about flights and a lot of money loss and a lot of bigger issues with plane flight too. So it's just kind of becoming a lot more complicated and a lot more muddled.
Well, yeah, and again, a lot of times they want to set a precedent in a lawsuit. And I've had this discussion with somebody who actually was a lawyer, and they had kind of a different view on it than I did. We were talking about the infamous McDonald's case. Mm. Lady gets burned by the hot coffee. She sues. She gets a lot of money. And obviously way more money than would be due somebody for something like that. And you should know it's hot, you know. But anyway, his point was, well, yeah, but they had to set a precedent. They had to be serious enough to make a big corporation make a change. And that's kind of that's at least what they say about it. I think at the end of the day, people want money. But you could see something like that too, saying, well, we got to go after him big time and get a lot of money, because if we don't, a big company like that, they won't change anything. So we're going to take a stand. Oh, and by the way, we're going to get a lot of money too.
Right.
So there's different sides of that. It all gets a little bit muddled there, but it'd be interesting to see what happens. I was thinking the other day, remember the Friendly Skies, Fly the Friendly Skies? What was one of the companies had that logo?
Yeah.
Or motto? And I thought, wow, it's sure not the Friendly Skies anymore, is it?
It was really funny on Twitter, people, all the funny GIFs, funny pictures, and all those sorts of things coming out from this. Just, and not to make light of it, but just the having videos of like staff training videos, and it's like a clip from a movie of like a pilot doing all these kung fu moves, all these different things. And so it was although, I mean, the situation there in Boston was unfortunate, but on social media, some people had some pretty good zingers from it.
You can always count on that. No matter what happens, there's going to be some comedians out there. You guys are millennials. I'm not quite. I'm a little older than that. And if you're looking to buy a house, they say it might be a little bit tougher. After years of many experts lamenting how millennials weren't interested in becoming homeowners, now everyone's interested in becoming a homeowner. So they say there's a lot of competition out there. Millennials are the largest group of home buyers, according to Ellie Mae, a software company that analyzes mortgage data. In January, millennials represented around 45% of all purchase loans. That's up from 42% the same month in 2016. And a lot more expected to jump in this spring trying to buy a home, first-time home ownership in a lot of cases. They say it's not going to be easy because they're mostly first-time buyers. They're competing against repeat buyers who have more buying leverage, more money. If you have more money, you have more leverage. And also, they say that there's a shortage of houses to some extent, which seems strange because there's always houses going up. A shortage of available homes has driven up prices, particularly among starter homes that tend to fall within the first-time buyers' budgets. And so if you guys are thinking about buying a house, good luck.
Yeah, luckily, I can kick the can down the road a little bit. So, but yeah, just when I was looking for a house a year ago or so, just looking around, see what the prices were, it is tough. Especially, I'm a foreigner, so it's even tougher for me to get a loan and everything because I don't have roots in the United States. If I want to do that, it's good luck. I either need to get lucky with a job or something like that in order to just not go into huge amounts of debt to get a loan, especially in places where it might have been booming earlier, like Oklahoma, like all the new houses are going up, which are really nice, but they're expensive too, and all the older houses are already taken, so it's kind of in that bind.
It's kind of hard to find the middle road because there are the more expensive homes, and then you can live pretty low too.
Yeah,
but that middle road is, I think, what a lot of people can afford and where they're looking, and I think those are a little tougher to get into.
Yeah, and probably a good way for millennials to possibly get a home over these repeat buyers would be to put a lot of money down on the house up front, except for the fact that most millennials are in hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt from college. So I don't think even in that way, millennials would have much of an advantage at all.
Yeah. If you've got cash, you're in a little better situation than if you don't. So anyway, that's kind of interesting data out there. There's this little note here I think is kind of interesting. Maybe you've seen this video. It's around the internet. It's on CNN. It's a pool, swimming pool. It's in a Market Square Tower in Houston. And it's 500 feet in the air, on top of the building pretty much. And part of the pool goes away from the building. And it's glass. So you can walk out onto this glass, part of this glass bottom pool, and it looks like there's nothing. Because it extends outside of the building. So you look down and you see the street.
Oof.
And so that's a glass bottom pool that they say will freak you out. And they have a video like shooting down at the guy walking. And he's pool, and then you take a step onto what appears to be nothing. There's something there, but it plays tricks with your mind. I don't know what I would do. I'm a chicken. I probably wouldn't do it.
Well, I've been in buildings where they have like the glass floor and like the big towers and everything. You can walk in and look down. And that's not too bad because it's not, there's water, some other kind of fluid in the way. But with that, I would be a little different because I think you feel more vulnerable that way than just walking around the building. So
yeah,
I mean, it's kind of a neat idea. I think a lot of people will want to do it, but hopefully the glass is really thick though.
They have a I want to say it's a slide in Los Angeles in a building that's similar. It's up at the top. It's a tourist attraction, but part of it goes outside the building and it's glass, so you've got to slide through this tube and it looks like you're in the air. And it caused some health problems for people. Like they had some medical emergencies, right? Because of, I guess, the panic or whatever.
Wow.
So there's a few things that are like that. And I mean, you know that it's okay, but it doesn't look okay. And it really messes with your mind.
That would be really terrifying. That pool where it goes out over the edge of the building, I would probably just be on the extreme opposite end of the pool, just holding on to the edge there. I would never even and get close to that part where you could see through it. It's made of glass. Couldn't it crack somehow?
It could. I mean, I am kind of like that too. You know, we all have that built-in sort of like fear of things like that. Like even say on a mountain trail or something, and it's not that far, but I get all nervous and I start like kind of almost wanting to get down on my hands and knees and not like look over there. I'm really bad at those things. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, actually up in Toronto, I've seen this video about it. It was the big tower up there.
Yeah, CN Tower.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can walk around the outside of that with bungees, like they strap those like belts to you, and you can walk outside just hooked up to these like, have you ever done it?
No, I haven't done it. I haven't been to the CN Tower myself, but I've seen it because, you know, Canadian television is four channels. So I always see things about the CN Tower on there. And but yeah, I probably wouldn't go that far. I mean, I'm not scared of heights usually. Maybe on top of the CN Tower would be a little different.
Yeah.
But it's some people love that stuff and they would love to do it. But and it's kind of a neat idea if you're into it. But I would rather just do... I like the view from inside the building. I wouldn't need to go outside.
Yeah. I never really understand... When people say, you know, being afraid of heights. I mean, I'm not afraid of heights if I'm safe.
Right.
If I'm about to fall, I'm terrified of it. You know, so I don't know. It must be more serious for some people where they just don't want to be up high.
Yeah, some people, they can't even climb a ladder because they're just afraid of falling. Or they just, I'm not sure exactly why that is. I mean, most people, I don't think, have a fear of heights. I mean, you're just afraid of hurting yourself. It's an unsafe situation. That makes sense. Like when you're rappelling for the first time or rock wall climbing, that's normal, I think. But some people get paralyzed, and they literally can't. Green Beret training, I was watching a video about it. And one thing they have to do, like on the second day they're there, they lay a ladder across two elevated platforms. And you have to walk across the ladder just with your feet, not with your hands.
Yeah.
Because in combat, they'll lay a ladder down. You have to run holding your weapon. You can't be crawling across because you're vulnerable, and always like 10 to 20 people drop out there because they literally can't let go. And it's not that far, like if you fell you'd be okay, but it's just in their mind they just can't get over it, and they just like, yeah, you can't be a part of a Green Beret if you can't walk across that ladder.
There's probably a lot of people out there saying, you know, I almost was a Green Beret,
yeah,
but it was that ladder. I couldn't do the ladder thing.
Yeah, well, that fear of heights, it really does have to do with whenever you're up high and you are actually safe, but your mind tricks you into thinking that you're actually not. Apparently, you can build up an immunity to that. My father used to paint water towers, and obviously, he started out wearing a harness, but then after a while, he just would like jump around up there, and I don't know how he did that, but it's pretty risky, but he wasn't afraid of it after a while.
I've heard that from people that paint high, very high things, that you do start out with the harness, but then it slows you down. Mm-hmm. And so they just said, forget it. And they just moved on. And
couldn't imagine.
I can't either. I can't either. Yeah. Hopefully they got paid a lot.
Yeah. Well, it's like the people who built the huge steel structures back in the, like the Empire State Building, those kind of things. Working up there, some of them have harnesses, most of them didn't. Just walk around those girders, riveting things, welding things, all those types of things. No harness, just thousands of feet or hundreds of feet in the air. It's just... I don't know.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. You're listening to Trump Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. We're broadcasting from the second story. but I feel pretty safe.
Definitely.
We're pretty well enclosed here. You can follow us on Twitter at KPCGFM. Also, if you'd like to email us, comments at KPCG.FM. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondo here today. Grant, you've got a write-up for us here. It's from the Washington Post. Kind of interesting. The title is this: Spicer. Hitler didn't even sink to using chemical weapons, although he sent Jews to the Holocaust Center. This all gets back to Syria using chemical weapons, and there, of course, an outcry, rightfully so. And then Spicer's come out and he made some comments about Hitler that's caused an uproar, I guess, in the media to some extent. And I haven't followed it super closely other than seeing the headlines. And I guess the thing that kind of struck me about it was it seems like a lot of uproar about some comments when there's like a actual much bigger issue going on. But what does Washington Post have to say about it?
Well, that is really the strange part of it, is how really today we seem like we get upset about the trivial things. And yet we've become totally desensitized to suffering all over the world. He made some comments that maybe weren't the most articulate, but it doesn't take much thought to figure out what he was trying to say. He basically said that not even Hitler stooped to using chemical weapons on his own people. And obviously Hitler used the gas chambers. That is where obviously those were some sort of chemical agent that killed a lot of Jews. But what he was talking about was, you know, dropping the bombs into towns like that. So it doesn't take much time to figure out what he was talking about. And yet the media is now calling for him to be fired and saying that he is a vicious anti-Semite because he said these things on the eve of what most people keep as the Passover. So they said that he was making comments like that on purpose.
Yeah. When I heard the story on the news, you know, I thought, okay, well, maybe he shouldn't have brought that. Maybe that's not a good historical reference to get into. But there is somebody out there right now who is using chemical weapons on their own people. It seems like that would be the bigger concern. And you could excuse maybe somebody for, you didn't care for what they said or they didn't say it right. I think we get the point. The point is that what's going on right now is really bad. And I thought that seems like that's the bigger story.
Yes. And it's pretty clear that Sean Spicer was not glorifying Hitler in any way. He was saying what Assad is doing right now is maybe in this way even worse than what the worst person of all time did, basically. So it's not a matter of him trying to excuse what Hitler did or deny the Holocaust, but that sort of, it just sort of struck me like maybe a moment where the media was kind of happy that the opposition slipped up and they pounced all over it. Never mind the fruits of the last administration that actually slighted Israel and disrespected them in every way possible through their actions, not through a slip of the tongue.
Yeah. I think one thing this can kind of do is it distracts from what I think the U.S. should probably be focusing on, which is how to deal with Assad and what to do over there, as opposed to somebody making a comment. And, you know, too, if you want to look back, I guess, at Hitler, the only thing that stopped Hitler was force, overwhelming force from the United States and Britain and so forth. And if there wasn't something holding Assad up, and there has been a little bit of pushback, what would stop him from doing these? I mean, he's already doing some horrible, horrible things over there. It's kind of, you don't want to get into comparing one tragedy to another. Tragedies are bad all the way around. But what's going on now is a tragedy, too. And how is it going to be stopped? I think if you want to look back historically, you'd say, okay, well, how did we stop problems in the past? It's always been force. It has to be. And it'd be the same thing in Syria. I think maybe that's the bigger historical thing to look at there.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's always a bad idea to reference Hitler in any way or make comparison. It just never really works out. And you always end up offending people, even if you articulate it perfectly. And probably Mr. Spicer should have done a much better job phrasing his statement because he is the press secretary. Like, that's what he's supposed to do. Nonetheless, though, that's not the big deal. The thing is, people, everyone in America, probably the world, knows about this story, but they have no idea what the U.S.'s strategy is on Syria, which Rex Tillerson articulated yesterday as well, but no one knows about that. And so it's, I think, like you said, they're missing the point that despite what one man might have said in a press conference, Assad is still on the loose, killing people indiscriminately, and not just killing his enemies, killing his own people, innocent people who had nothing to do with the conflict. And with probably over 500,000 dead already, I think it's the media needs to focus more on not pointing the finger at our own government as an enemy, but at the actual enemies of the United States, and that's Assad and other regimes, terrorist organizations. I saw the Daily News. I guess it's like a Washington, D.C. daily newspaper. Their big headline was, "The White House Forgets the Holocaust." Right. And this sensationalistic news, it isn't news at all. And I think it just shows that the media would rather degrade their political enemies than actually tell the American people about how the world's falling in on itself. And that's a pretty dangerous state of mind when the people who vote for make decisions of government in some capacity are left in the dark because the media is picking and choosing what they want to attack, I guess.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it'd be interesting for anybody involved in say the media there or politics or whatever, just stop and reflect a little bit and say, well, what's the bigger issue? Is the bigger issue that I get in power or my side gets the upper hand, or that we do something to stop these innocent people from being gassed to death? What's the bigger issue?
Well, that's the problem. It's pretty clear what the priority is, and it's not the right one. It really is about winning at all costs, degrading the opposition, the political opposition, not the actual enemies of the country, at all costs. And at this point, the media is just spewing lies, and they know exactly what they're saying. They have pounced on this slip of the tongue to advance this false narrative that the entire Trump administration is anti-Semitic. That's what they were posting in this Washington Post article as well. All these things, it's like any little chance that they get, they're just trying to undermine the presidency, which doesn't seem to really help us that much. And by the way, Mr. Trump's son-in-law is Jewish, and his own daughter practices Jewish customs. So I don't think he's an anti-Semite, and yet that's what they're saying.
It's interesting, but it is a big deal going on there in Syria, that write-ups from the Washington Post, and they're getting into some of the semantics a little more than what's going on the ground, I think. You've got, moving on from that, Abraham, you've got a write-up here, much less serious, I guess, if you want to say it. That's hard to transition. That's a hard-hitting story there, but this is from the Japan Times. We've all dealt with this, I guess. Catastrophic failure, why shoelaces mysteriously come untied.
Yes, I immediately saw the story and
double knot them. Problem solved.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes.
That's exactly what I do until I knot them in such a way where it becomes a noose for my other shoe and I trip and fall. but that's, I immediately saw this because it's one of the great mysteries of mankind. I guess all of us, we're walking along and our shoes are always untied at the worst possible times.
Especially if you're like 10 or under.
Yes.
you find that out as you have children. Oh, I need to tie that again, do I? Yeah. Get them Velcro.
Yeah, so these scientists actually did a full scientific study of why this happens and different knots and their different strengths.
Who funded
strengths.
This? Who funded this study?
It doesn't say.
It better have been self-funded. Probably not, though.
I think it was at a university, and the university did it to help teach them how to do scientific research.
Uh-huh.
But they even had a robot that would like walk and run, and they put shoes on and tie in to test the stability of the shoelace.
Don't we have humans that wear shoes? Couldn't you just pay somebody?
We don't want to run, though.
Put a robot on. Yeah, yeah.
I guess they couldn't find any volunteers who'd be willing to run for an extended period of time. But I guess this was done in Paris. So they're paying people thousands of dollars to sleep in a bed for 60 days and also built a robot to run in place. But basically, this is pretty interesting, and they call it the catastrophic failure. So that's when catastrophic failure in science means when something absolutely fails, and they're applying that to when a shoelace becomes untied because it's failing in its job.
Right.
And so they're saying most of the time it's not a big deal. It's just kind of an inconvenience. But there's actually a bunch of different accidents that happen every year around the world, and here's just a few from shoelaces. A van driver killed a motorcyclist when his shoestring wound so tight around the accelerator he couldn't lift his foot off the gas, and so he hit someone. A boy got his leg pulled into an escalator because the shoelace was too long and it got caught on the side.
You know what? I've seen news reports about that, and I am always, like with myself or my kids, I always look when I get to the bottom of the escalator. People get their pants caught in there or a shoelace, and you can lose your leg.
Wow.
Yeah, or you know, something.
It's just a huge machine, like gears going around.
Yep.
And then another one, a cyclist who sailed over the handlebars into traffic because his shoelace got caught and he couldn't get his feet down in time. So these actually, they can cause pretty serious accidents. And so millions of shoelaces come unfurled every day. And why does that happen? So basically, they had mechanical engineers from the University of California at Berkeley come over and they would film the knots as people were running or when this machine was running, to try to figure out the different forces at play. And it's kind of interesting in a weird way, I guess, that when you're running, so when a normal person runs, when your foot hits the ground, it's hitting the ground at 7 times the force of gravity. So when your foot's stationary, gravity is just pulling down on the shoelace. But when you're running, it's seven times that. And when your foot comes down, it tightens the knot from the force. And then the legs of the knot, the two loops,
mm-hmm.
they're swinging around, and it pulls at the knot in the opposite direction, weakening it further. And they're saying basically it's a combination of the downward force of your foot and then the laces swinging around everywhere that causes the knots to come unloose eventually. Maybe some of us could have figured that out already. But but anyway, they have scientific evidence of it, and it's kind of a neat thing that they did here. And they tried different types of knots on this robot to see which was better. Eventually, all knots have catastrophic failure at some point. But they say basically double knots are the best. And they say false knots are like if you tie kind of like a half knot on your shoe, they come apart the easiest. But in any event, that's why our shoelaces come untied.
There you go.
All the time. Yeah.
Yeah. Early on, probably kindergarten, somebody told me to double knot them.
Yeah.
Been doing it ever since.
Yeah.
Very rarely do I have a double knot come undone. It happens, but it's pretty rare. If you happen to get a shoe that has leather shoelaces, now you're in for a challenge because those guys do not want to stay. They do not want to stay.
Wow. Yeah.
I have heard, though, that if you make the knot and you, if it's leather and you like moisten it with water or something and then tie it, that'll keep it. It'll dry in that position.
Okay.
I got all. How do I know so much about shoelaces?
Yeah, you should write a book.
Yeah. Shoelace coffee table book.
Yeah. But I've had flat shoelaces, but I've tied them so tight I can't get them apart.
No.
Because you just, like, I'm just using all my strength to make sure they're tight, playing sports or whatever. You don't want your shoe flying off. And I discovered on my work boots, because I have the really long laces, if I wrap them around the top of the boot, and I tie really small loops. They never come undone because the loops are so small. They don't flail around everywhere.
Hmm. I have a mental hang-up about wrapping them around my... for some reason, I'm afraid that my leg will get caught and I won't be able... It'll, like, take my leg off. So I never wrap them around.
Yeah. Maybe there is a story about that.
Probably is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On an escalator. Yeah, you'd have to be careful with escalators. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, there you go. That's the exact scientific reason. How long did it take them to figure that out?
It doesn't say. Maybe that's for the best.
Years and months.
But yeah, they probably have hundreds of hours of footage of knots in slow motion.
the thing that amazes me the most about it is that they had to build a robot.
Yeah.
Like, why? Just put it on a human being.
Well, I think just the main reason they did that is it's probably easier to film someone than, like, on a treadmill. Like, it's just less convenient, and a person might get tired and stop or do something wrong you don't want them to do. A robot can do it consistently over and over again.
I could just see years from now they're going through like the old storage bins over there and they're like, what did they ever do with this robot? So he's like, oh, that was the shoestring robot. Very interesting. You got one more story for us today, not related to shoestrings. We are on a shoestring budget, by the way. This is from Task and Purpose. It's the only thing I could think of with shoestring in it. This is a pretty good story. This veteran couple married against the odds, and their first dance was nothing short of a miracle. What's the story here?
Yeah, this is a really nice story, and it's kind of a nice note to end on with the world falling apart and all the terrible videos over the weekend. It is a really nice story. This man, Thomas Matineau, he was an Air Force veteran, and he became paralyzed after a motorcycle accident. And he met this other lady, Kirsten Downs, who was also an Air Force veteran, and they got married. They met after he was in a wheelchair. And all their friends came together, a lot of veterans in the Air Force community, and they helped get their wedding ready. And so I think what the best part of this is, at their wedding, because the first dance, the bride and the groom dance, but he's in a wheelchair. So they didn't really know what they're going to do. They both had kids from previous relationships, it looks like. So they're going to have, she was going to sit on his lap and he was going to go around and the kids were going to get a kind of dance with them. That was their plan. But when they walked in, after getting the pictures taken, they walk into the room and all their friends had built this really extensive cable and pulley system where Thomas, he could put it some loops under his arm, and he could actually stand up and dance with his wife because the pulleys would support him, and he could move around the room. And it's the first time he's walked in almost 10 years.
Wow.
And he was able to walk around and dance with her. And the video's on this. It's on at Task and Purpose. You can watch the video on there of them dancing. And he said he just couldn't believe. People might not think it's a big deal, but for him, after he became paralyzed, he lost a lot of his self-worth. I mean, he was a pretty accomplished Air Force veteran. Now, all of a sudden, you can't even walk.
Right.
And so he struggled with that for a while. And he just being able to hold his wife, stand up, be taller than her, and dance with her was just a really emotional moment for both of them. And it's all possible because their friends all did this. And it's really a neat system they made. I mean, it's pretty ingenious.
Yeah, I was going to say, you'd have to have some knowledge to know how to even think to do that, and then to know how to build it and have it work correctly.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and it's just a really nice story where all their friends came together and probably gave him a wedding gift, the best one that they could have, just a really nice memory. And he said it helped him give his self-worth back and help him feel like the man who he was before the accident.
Right.
And so that was just a really nice thing they did. And then this is their story, how they came together. Just both of them had really struggled with their previous relationships. They weren't, especially the bride, she wasn't sure if she would get married again. But she met him when he was in the wheelchair, and she decided that it was probably best for her to marry him, just for both of them. And he was just a really amazing man, that he could be so positive despite being paralyzed. And so they're happily married now, and it's just a really nice story, I guess, when the world's a lot of selfish stories, a lot of things like that. But their friends gave them a really nice wedding gift.
Yeah, some people really have a knack for that, like thinking about what would really mean something to another person and then setting about to do it. And like you said, I mean, it would be hard to understand, I guess, how special it would be unless you were in that position. And so they knew him well enough to know that would really mean a lot to him. I'm sure they all had talked to him, and he'd probably talked about how difficult it was. And so, you know, that would be just pretty an amazing thing to see. And so that video is online at Task and Purpose, which is pretty cool. That's nice to have friends like that. Those are good friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes you wonder what the world would be like if everyone took that much time to be considerate of others and give in that kind of a way. Everything would change, really.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you look at the difference. Isn't that so interesting? You look at the difference in humans depending on certain situations. You know, in one country, you have somebody, a leader, killing his own people, and then here you have friends getting together to help their friend walk. Mm-hmm. And everybody's a human being in this scenario, of just very different spirits and different ways of going about things.
Yeah, there's lots of problems in the world, and unfortunately, that's what most of the news focuses on. But it is still nice to reflect on some moments when people are selfless, and then the benefits of it. Like Grant mentioned, just it's obviously much better to be giving and to be thoughtful. And I know just going to a couple of weddings here in the next few months, trying to think of a wedding gift. Well, to get something that's not just like a towel or something on the registry, but something that's meaningful. I did bring a towel as a wedding gift once.
Everybody needs a towel. I don't care who you are.
It's yeah, true.
They're important.
They were very thankful for it because it was a nice towel, I guess. I bought them a few, and my cat the night before went into the bag and was like clawed up one of the towels and ruined it. Luckily, the receipt was in there. But I should have just given the cat too.
did the store refund you your money on it?
Oh, I don't know. I think they brought it back. And I think they got their money back.
Yeah. Sometimes I was always curious of what stores will refund your money on. Like, wow, my cat had destroyed this. So, because I could see the store being like, oh, it's not my problem. Yeah. It's your cat.
That's just another case against cats. I didn't like them already.
Don't leave them around towels. You can't trust them.
But with this, I mean, just, I never would have thought of this, that the thing he wants most is to be able to walk and spend that moment with his wife. So, just if everyone was that thoughtful and really sought to give someone something like that, not on that scale, but something like that every day, I think it would go a long way in alleviating a lot of the issues we have.
Yeah, and you would have to know the person really well, because I think you could think, well, would it be embarrassing for them, or you know, do they not want to draw attention to something? So you'd have to really know them well. So that I think it highlights it's that they knew the person well enough to know exactly what would mean the most.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was family and friends, and they've been with him through his whole experience there, and the accident, and so they knew exactly what he wanted, probably because he talked about it a lot and that sort of thing. So yeah, you can't do that to strangers, but family. That's what family's there for. Is to help people out like this and give them kind of special memories.
Yeah, pretty neat story to end on today. The Key David program's coming up, also the Trumpet Daily Radio Show and the Trumpet Hour program. All of that is on the way today here on KPCG. It's all the time that we have on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for spending some of your Wednesday with us. For myself, Dwight Folk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau, enjoy the rest of your day. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.